Yes, and nice to hear Longview mention that. That kicked off a lot of the things since I retired and produced the journal initially, and then the Society for Longitudinal and Life Course Studies, which is had recently held a meeting that Ben was at, and many of you, I think, in Germany, Bamberg. So there's been quite a nice follow through to my career as doing this work, to actually setting up what I would call the infrastructure for its continuation. And that's what we have now in this field, the need for infrastructure continuity, because of the huge investment that's involved in these studies, which at one time were just one-off projects. And I often describe them as like cottage industries, which have now turned into national investments, producing returns, vitally important to government, all these things that even 15, 20 years ago were unimagined. So the world has changed. And what I want to do in this talk is examine some of the reasons for that, and then look at a couple of case studies, where the world is going, and then the challenges and problems that come with, at one level, this huge success, but at the same time, this huge responsibility and, in a sense, tension with the whole world in which these studies operate, both on the policy front, but also the people contributing to them. And we have to recognize all these elements of what is a very important, I think, continuing development in this world, the need for evidence of this particular kind, while societies develop, evolve, and change. And change is the element of so much of what I want to talk about. So let's begin. This is really what I want to cover in my talk. Now, if I've got the thing, yes, right. Where the thing began, but only very briefly, then the contemporary study, the studies we now have at our fingertips or in our organisations like here and throughout other centres in Australia, and what those studies consist of and where the priorities lie with them, then go back into looking at some issues of design, the parameters in which we set these longitudinal projects. And a particular view I take of this, which is really what I'd call the life course perspective and where that takes us. And then see how that plays out in the studies that I've been responsible for, the birth cohort studies based, as Ben has said, in London at the Centre for Longitudinal Studies. And then look at a couple of case studies of them in practice to get an idea of some of these principles, how they work out, moving more towards the policy outcome of the work, which is, of course, the whole point of it, particularly so much of the funding is coming from government. And finally, challenges and solutions to those challenges that the whole of this field faces. And do interrupt me if anything's unclear, and I'll try and put it right as we go along, and then I hope we have time for discussion at the end. Okay, well, let's move on. Can I read this? I'm just about, yeah. The reasons why, and I recently published a chapter in a book called The Handbook of the Life Course, the reason why there has been this transformation, which you can put back mainly to about 1990, is for a number of reasons. I mean, the first and foremost is technological change, the kind of digital world we now live in, and what that both promises and challenges in terms of what is now available on a number of fronts in terms of the development of longitudinal research, longitudinal studies, and particularly in my terms, the whole life course approach. So, you know, it wasn't so long ago when the idea of having multi-dimensional 10 multi-gigabyte data sets on your desktop was unimaginable, and now it's taken for granted. And by 1990, up until then, there was this huge interest and development in the ideas for every element of the longitudinal research process, going through formulation of questions, what data could be collected through analysis, and then the conclusions to be drawn, and the theory in which these observations should be located from design points of view, but also in interpreting the results. So we've had this First of all, this massive shift in technology, and we're only seeing the beginning of it. I mean, just imagine the world in 20 years' time in terms of what's been achieved since 1990. High-speed desktop computing, so every individual researcher is equipped in their own space to do work which at one time had to be done queuing up on mainframe computers and waiting for jobs to run overnight. All that sort of stuff is what I grew up with. And I think, as I say, the move to this digital world in round about the 1990s was when these what were ideas, things that were aspirations and commitments of various kinds to the future couldn't be achieved. And they now, of course, are all within reach of everybody who's involved in this world. And just coming back briefly to the conference I've just been at in Canberra, it was amazing to me to see almost hundreds of people with the capability to do this stuff, you know, doing it in their desktops, talking about amazing work that you would never have imagined 20, 30 years ago. The other aspect, obviously, of technology is the facility for data storage, which has gone on at a rate of knots, and the facility that offers, not only for secondary analysis, so you open up the analysis community on a huge scale across the world around any data set once it becomes publicly available. And alongside that is the growth of repositories, that publications now are available through entirely different sources than they were in the past. And part of the whole process is depositing digitally produced publications, because that is an essential means of protecting them. There's a great risk with digital material that can disappear without trace unless there is somebody looking after it. So all our stuff, for example, is located on a repository in Stanford called, what's it called? LOX, that's right. And everything that we produce will be located there, and also in the British Library in Britain. So there's this huge facility then now for secondary analysis, increasing the scale of use on a massive scale. And that leads to the next huge development, which is methodological, this opportunity to use things that were only in the minds of mathematicians and converting them into the actual work of day-to-day research. A classic example of that is structural equation modeling, which I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, are very familiar with. And that began with Carl Juriskog, a mathematical statistician in Sweden, who then worked with somebody called Dag Storbom, a computer scientist, who actually was able to turn Juriskog's mathematical ideas into what became structural equation modeling and the LISREL program, which then has spawned so many variations. M+, of course, is now the thing in which almost the state of the art structural equation modeling is located. And the people who produced that were, in fact, students. I don't know, one, the... What was his name? I can't remember. Bengt Muten, who was a PhD student of Juriskog, of course, and settled in Stanford, where he married, and his wife, and he produced the M+. So statistical modeling all became possible of that kind, but also other kind of more rarefied versions of it, which were the sequence analysis, for example, which until that time was very little used. Latent class analysis, whole strings of analytical possibilities became quite straightforward and easy to do. And now, of course, they're produced within packages where you write your own programs and mix them with the standard packages that are now most of these things like multi-level modeling or structural equation modeling become. So statistical modeling now is, again, all very much part of the scene for everybody, you doing PhDs or whatever their position they are in the whole organization, to leaving, in fact, their seniors behind very often, which means, of course, that's the difficult side for some of us, that you can't keep up. But the third thing, and this is the most important, and I want to pause a bit more on this, is theoretical development, because up until that time, you might say, there was a very linear way of thinking about how life developed, the life course, and where the future lay for individuals. What were the processes? It was seen that an individual was moving through a series of influences through which they were surviving or surmounting these environmental pressures and effects upon them, into a much more different kind of rarefied view, more interdisciplinary, more holistic, the whole person rather than individual bits of their lives being studied in depth, and very wide-ranging in terms of the variables that were encompassed, because analytic potential now allowed that, the capability to really range very widely, and to get away from looking at the life course in different, or rather standardized, as I said, linear routes to multiple pathways and multiple outcomes where different areas of life would be studied conjointly, the family and the workplace, the community. All of them became part of a much more complex but much more convincing picture of how life developed. And that's really where I think theory took off. So let's move on from that to see where this has got us in terms of the projects that now currently exist, the data collection side of all this through the studies of the kind that you're running here yourself, LSAC, obviously, particularly, and of course this one about the indigenous population, which I'm hoping to hear about later. So I won't go through these in detail, but as you can see, they represent a kind of portfolio that you would find in many countries like this, certainly in the UK, exactly this set of studies is available. Most European countries, US, all the rest of it, where there is a shortage and a poverty that needs to be removed is perhaps in the Southern Hemisphere, particularly in the African countries, for example, where there's some work going on, but nothing like on the scale that goes on in Northern Europe and in places like Australia and New Zealand, and increasingly East Asia. So all of this is on the way, and the need to spread expertise is another big challenge, which I think we shouldn't forget, because it's essential for any society, and they're all going through processes that are not that dissimilar, to have the opportunity to monitor the effects of change on the life courses of the individuals in the populations to which these countries relate. So the other forms of project, which are very common, quasi-sequential cohorts, simply in your own case, you have two cohorts, one beginning at birth and one a little older, I think four or five years old. And that's an example of where you have the opportunity to catch up fast on age because you've got 4 years ahead of the birth cohort, which you have to wait longer for before you get to, say, schooling, and you can explore your interest in that. So many studies have a series of sequential cohorts, like the very big German study, NEPS, the National Education Panel, which has six cohorts starting at different ages. The last age is adulthood, the first one is birth. And so you've got the whole future there at one point, in one sense, while the younger part of that evidence base is taking time to get to the part that the older cohorts already at. The other major changes in aging studies, they didn't exist until relatively recently, probably in the last 20 years. And that's another huge growth where there's much coordination across projects, across, certainly in Europe, there's a massive collaboration called the Health and Retirement in Europe study, where these different aging studies operating on the same template for design can then be linked in terms of that comparative interest in how the policies for aging in different countries interact with the populations that are passing through them. Data linkage, the other major change, which is of course massive. I've heard a lot about that in the last few days and has huge opportunities, but also massive challenges. I won't go on to it any further now. Then household panel studies, of course, which Hilda is a classic example, also linked in an amazing collaboration called the Cross CNIF. What is it? The Cross National. Anyway, it's a coordinated six studies in a coordinated data set, which is Hilda is one of them. And that's an example of an amazing collaboration across the world. But finally, and this is the most important, I think, where the world is moving and a very high priority extends, and that is for the development more of comparative studies, both within countries, but also across countries, where the opportunity to look at data in different social and policy contexts comes into its own if you can pursue the matter through that route, through work with others. Very costly in terms of time and effort, but nevertheless hugely rewarding when it works. And finally, well, one which I've heard about here a bit and I'm very, very enthusiastic about is intergenerational extensions, the moving not just from the studies of the cohort members or the study members, but their parents on the one hand, and even the parents' parents, and then, of course, the children. So the core sample on which the population is really based is that of the sample members, but the others, almost as attributes of those members, become the means by which intergenerational transfers, continuities, discontinuities can be investigated. And I think that's hugely exciting development, but of course very expensive again in time and money to actually extend the project with repeated measures on those four elements. And in our own case, we just covered children of our studies on one occasion. We didn't follow them up, whereas the ideal, of course, is to follow up the children as well as the parents in these projects. So that's where we are. And let's now look at the possibilities for coming to some general, well, a general design template, if you like, for this work. And I like this picture as a way of doing that. This sets out the elements of the design that is involved in one way or another in all these studies. On the left-hand axis, I don't know whether you can see it, it's a bit fuzzy, is the age of the of a cohort or a population. Along the bottom line is the the year in the study in which the study took place, and then you've got going across in diagonals a series of cohorts, quasi-sequential cohorts in terms of the top line and the line below it, and the line below it is the one beginning from birth, the birth cohort study. So you've got this, you can see here the relationships between longitudinal data and that collected by other means. The cross-sectional study, for example, would be the vertical lines on that diagram, because it's simply taking slices of the population for which data are collected at different historical time points. And then going back from that, these other boxes are replications across countries, that's where the comparative element comes, or experimental designs where you could actually be changing the population on some dimensions while comparing those effects of those changes with the core population as summarized in this first box in relation to the follow-up of individuals across time through these various kinds of design that we've just seen in the previous slide. And this brings me to a point that I should have made earlier. I didn't really explore the third element as much as I should in the development of change and how this whole area has taken off, and that's in relation to theory. Because one of the main opportunities that the great technological changes produced was the opportunity to implement theory in a much broader scale, and the life course perspective of Glenn Elder, derived particularly from his work of children and the Great Depression, is one of the major staples in the development of this whole field. And this is why I want to pursue this a bit further, the life course. Alongside it comes other theoretical development like Bronfenbrenner, that social social ecological approach to the development of individuals, which of course is very popular in the kinds of studies of the LSAC kind. And that one is it leads to the whole use of multi-level modeling, of course, to actually examine the effects of ecologies at different levels, the family, the community, the country as a whole, in taking account of how the different levels contribute to the development of the individual through those influences in this multi-level modeling framework. Another particular direction that it's all going, as I mentioned, is the move away from linear considerations to multiple pathways, and all of this becomes encompassable in this new framework. So let's focus now then on just the particular life course perspective. Now, this has a number of elements in it, four components, but basically the basic principle that development occurs in context. And the multi-level modeling example is an example of that. But I mean, the individual is very much shaped, or their development is shaped through this different sets of influence, and some of them are particularly important in this life course framework. The first is human agency, the development of the individual and how the individual shapes their future as well as being shaped by it. The next is linked lives, the fact that social relations are a critical part of that development, one of the other components of development. Then we've got timing, and this is particularly important, the intersection of age, period, and cohort effects. In other words, the age the individual is at, the period when the data are collected, and the cohort they're in, which is the birth cohort through which they have started life and then are passing through it. These are all very critical components of what occurs on that diagonal that you just saw across the original framework. And the fourth element is location in time and space, history and culture and structure, which is where the individual is placed within society, within that historically, but also culturally and structurally in terms of their location in occupation or whatever, which structures in some sense the lives they're going to lead. So I think the critical contribution of Elder and others who've developed this idea comes through this idea of time as being a critical part of the whole process. And the issue of age, period, and cohort effects becomes terribly important when it comes to design matters. So let's just turn now to an example of this, and I'll move to our own studies in the Centre for Longitudinal Studies in London. This is a diagram of the British... Oh, this keeps on falling on the floor. Hold on. This is a diagram mapping onto that previous one I showed you of the blocks, which in this case is mapping out the series of birth cohort studies. And these are not quasi-sequential. These are sequential cohorts that have taken place in Britain since the Second World War. And the fact we had the amazing visionaries, James Douglas, Neville Butler, and people of this kind, who actually thought of developing this work years and years before there was any real possibility of doing longitudinal analysis or anything with it, but their belief that this way of examining the development of a population was going to be enormously important, originally for medical purposes, monitoring the National Health Service and its effects in Britain, but ultimately on a much wider scale as individuals grew up. So these studies began initially with perinatal mortality studies from birth. First one was the 46 cohort, and we can see it tracing its course, life course, across time through age groups and across years. On the horizontal axis are the years in which data were collected. And the 46 cohort is the grandparent of all of them, you might say, and we're incredibly fortunate to have had the opportunity that now is produced by this amazing work that these early individuals did. believing in something that couldn't be realized in practice fully for years. Following that, 12 years later, to see how the National Health Service, established in 1947, 1948, I think, was working out, was the National Child Development Study, 1958. You see these samples are very large. The first one took a subsample of the total population, but roughly 17,000 births occur in Britain every week. And the National Child Development Study took the whole sample and followed them up 12 years later. And then there was a third beginning in 1970, which is the 1970 cohort study. And that similarly had 17,000, the whole lot followed up. Then there was a long gap because there was resistance to doing more birth cohort studies. Clinical medicine, in fact, said we know everything we need to know from the 46 cohort. We don't need to find anything else out. Then why do we should be spending the money on clinical medicine and that form of research? And it was an argument which prevailed at the time. So it took 30 years before the series could be restored, a series which has enormous merit and value, to the point where ALSPAC, the one that fitted in 1982, which was an area-based study located in Bristol, is now seen as a critical part of this cohort series. Because as you'll appreciate, of course, that the advantage of having this series of studies is to be able to examine cohort effects, to what extent the experiences people are having in terms of the circumstances, policies to which they're exposed, are actually shifting their way, the lives they're shaped. And the studies were renewed in the iconic year 2000, which is really what stimulated the study here. And all these growing up studies across a number of countries came in 2000. And we were fortunate too. It was offered by government. Why don't we celebrate the millennium by restoring this series? And that's where the Millennium Cohort Study, as we call it, with about 20,000 babies in it to begin with, began in 2000 with a rather different design from the earlier one. The earlier ones were all based on a single week's birth. The Millennium expands across a whole year. And finally, there is another one listed which began, which is the Life Study, due to begin originally in 2012, but actually didn't get going then. It floundered, and in fact, it's been terminated, sadly, while a review is being done to see what should be done to replace it and where the future of all these studies should lie. That was a very large one. It was going to involve 100,000 babies, modeled on the American National Children's Study to a certain extent, which also floundered. And so you can see these studies can be rather vulnerable to various pressures to either continue them or end them. And in this case, very sadly, many of us think the Life Study was wound up. So you can see then from all this that the very great potential there is from a set of studies like this to examine the changing life course. And that's what comes from a diagram this. As you look across any parallel line, take age 30, for example, if you want to know what's happening to 30-year-olds over a period of time encompassing birth cohorts from 46 right up to the millennium, then you only have to compare across those data at, say, age 30 across the six studies that are listed there. And so there you have this purchase on the cohort effect, which I think is an enormously important part of this whole scenario program. So now let's look at a few examples of, well, a couple of them actually in practice, of how this kind of work can be applied in practice, and or this kind of conceptualization, I should say, the life course and how it maps out through age, period, and cohort effects. This is a project done on obstacles and opportunities on the route to adulthood, and I thought it was appropriate because the LSAC data or samples are now in very much in the period of age 12 to 16. I think that's correct, isn't it? Which is the period moving out of childhood in, of course, from puberty into the teens and then the youth phase, as we call it, of the life course, extending up to the early to mid 20s, depending how you divide it. So this one relates to that, and it's based particularly on the 70 and the 58 cohort, the stage they had reached in their lives, and what one could say about the way their lives were shaping around about this period of the middle teens. Now, just as we're talking about development in context, so one of the things that's enormously important to say, well, what was going on in society between the 70 and the 58 cohort, which was making a difference? Well, certainly in Britain, and I think it was probably the same case here, it was a period of massive industrial upheaval. While traditional industries went to the wall, the new economies of the East took over a lot of traditional industries. Such things as coal mining disappeared. The whole steel industry was under huge threat in Britain. And a whole generation faced a set of closed opportunities that used to exist and no longer did. And producing first a thrust towards extended education to get through this problem, but secondly, a greater polarization of the whole society with those who didn't have the resources or the will to adjust their lives to the new situation were very much under pressure and forced into what we now call a precariat situation of marginalization and exclusion, with a lot of physical and mental and psychological problems often attached to this. So social exclusion characterized by disadvantaged family background circumstances and poor educational career, also differentiated by demographic factors, including gender, ethnicity, geographical location, and culture. That's what we have. And so that was the context. Well, that's how this played out by looking at structural equation models of how this could be mapped out and what was the effect on individual lives through these massive changes. Also, globalization, of course, was another major factor. This is a very simple model, a very linear one in form, but nevertheless quite useful in showing how family background produces impacts on early influences coming from schooling and the family. Leaving choices when you're in the teens, what are you going to do? Stay on at school or leave at the first opportunity, then employment and family, or lack of it, unemployment, and that's the dependent variable I want to look at briefly here. And we're passing through at in the age part of the concept, the design, age at 10 to 11 and age at 16 is where formative influences and decision choices are being made. And we also in this study looked at rural-urban distance. Differences and the interaction of these effects coming from where the locality of living impacted on the way the life course was mapping out. So this is a structural equation model. As I've said, we look at influences before age 10, then 10 to 11, then 16 plus, outcomes at 21 to 23. And a selection from vast numbers of variables, but one has to be more specific. So theoretically driven choices were made of the variables to include. And we look at mother had left education, father left education, family, social class at the beginning. And this is the baseline set of influences. And then we see the outcomes occurring in mass scores, reading scores, mother's interest in education, father's interest, and overcrowding in the home. And these are all 10 to 11 influences and outcomes. And then finally, 16 plus, not finally, a range of influences building on the previous set. Again, outcomes, exam scores, literacy scores, but also introducing things like malaise, which is an indication of psychological mood, or depression is another way of looking at it, is also included in that set. Age left education, malaise is, as I've said, this mood factor, and whether there had been any work-based training or not en route. And then you've got the outcome is a measure of unemployment, how much time spent unemployment since leaving school, and then the outcome measured at age 21, 23. Well, let's see what it looks like. This is the age 58 cohort. And if you model the processes between 10 and before 10 and then at 11, you see that it's totally dominated by social class. There's no other real factor that showed up at that point. What happened to the 70 cohort? That's how complicated the world for young people had become, because now not only the social class of the family, as measured by parents, father's occupation or parents' occupation, was critically important, but now the age the mother left education and the age the father left education now come very much into the prediction or explanation of what will be happening next, and where these outcomes can be seen to be related across the board to these three different factors. What about this next stage up? The 58 cohort, very simple yet again. Exam scores, numeracy scores, number of jobs held, predicted unemployment. 70 cohort, have those same variables involved, but also notice malaise is in there, depression, psychological state. Didn't appear at all in the 58 cohort, but now it's there along with number of jobs. And in a most fascinating way, social class survives all the variables that intervened between it and unemployment, representing a kind of residual effect from family circumstances at birth. In other words, there's a component, almost of a cultural kind, which was coming through to affect the outcome, which in this case is, as I've said, unemployment. So this gives you an idea of, I think, of why cohort effects matter. And therefore, there is a case for, to repeat studies. You've already got two cohorts in yours showing a cohort effect. But if you want to do repeat the whole exercise in, say, 10 years' time, you have the opportunity then to see the sort of effects that are happening as society changes in the dramatic way it did in the 1980s. And now has again, and I've been doing work on this recently, the effect of the most recent recession, the 2007-2008, has similar set of effects to these that we're seeing way back in the 80s, and we're just producing a book which will be out in the next few months on this very new situation and the consequences for it. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it's simply to say that it's very powerful as a means of measuring, assessing, observing how society changes are impacting on people's lives and producing a whole different set of challenges and problems, of which the precariat, I think, in my own personal view, is one of the strongest problems of all. A disenchanted, disenfranchised, alienated section of the population that is not just restricted to the unskilled working class, but spreading right up through levels of education, almost to university students. Some graduates themselves are moving into this particular marginalized class through inability to make the transition into employment when they leave. But that's a very big story and I won't go further with it now. The next thing, and then I should be beginning to wind up, I think, is what I call the trajectory of disadvantage. I talked about this in Canberra as well. But this comes from work I did with a colleague, Samantha Parsons, over 15 years, devoted to the origins of adult basic skills, literacy and numeracy difficulties. And this was very much concerned looking right up to the 30s, particularly, of where these problems came from, why some adults had gone through a whole system of education and never made it into a level of literacy and numeracy that would enable them to continue in education. So there was a whole series of studies at different ages and stages looking at what the explanations of this were. And out of it came this idea of a trajectory of disadvantage, which is reflected in this diagram. First of all, the point is made that the long reach of childhood, this shows, in fact, that what happens in adulthood is can be very much predicted from what happens early on. So this diagram shows how, well, on the horizontal scale, are different levels of adult literacy as measured by national tests for monitoring this in the adult population. Entry level 2, entry level 3, very, very low literacy. Level 1 is below L, on the right-hand side, is below about the level of an 11-year-old's literacy performance. Now, that discrimination between those levels of adult literacy and simple measures of a cognitive test of measuring visual motor skills shows this very strong gradient. In other words, those who were performing badly at age 5 when they were measured on their cognitive development were similarly going to predict a poor performance in adulthood. And very similarly for men and women, it's much the same gradient for both. And the measure itself is interesting, copying design, which becomes, as it turns out, a very important skill in the beginning stages of literacy. And clearly these young kids who as adults ended off quite poorly on the literacy and numeracy stakes were actually beginning to show early on the poor acquisition of this particular set of skills. And that's how the gradient worked out. And this is a stretch from 5 to 34. Well, it just shows one example of what is a whole range of connections of this kind that can be established across time and across age. Let's see how the whole picture then added together. I don't know whether you can see it, but I'll tell you what it shows. On the left are the stages of life through which we examine the development of the trajectory of disadvantage. 0 to 13, which is obviously up to adolescence. Then adolescence to young adulthood, the youth phase, and then adulthood 25 plus in this framework. And on the next column shows the different forms of disadvantage at these different stages, which could be assessed and then seen as the foundations of the what was to follow. Education outcome came next. Preschool cognitive skills I've already mentioned, and then various forms of educational outcome, and in this case showing education poorly developed, poor acquisition of qualifications, so leaving school early and all the rest of it, and then absence of any employer-based training when entry into the labour market had occurred. Then on the right side, and I think this is terribly important, is the various interventions that turned into policies in relation to these kinds of evidence as they were collected at different stages in these projects. So Every Child Matters was a very important British policy to guarantee nursery education, preschool provision for everybody free of charge. Then Sure Start was an intervention project targeting disadvantaged families through centres where parents could be shown how to help their children educationally from the very earliest stage before actual school entry occurred, when they could be lost and isolated in large classrooms and all the rest of it. And then this follows through at 14 to 22, educational maintenance allowances, connections with a counselling service. The EMAs were to support people staying on in further education. And then counselling was another important part to help them make these choices in these complex pathways that they were confronting in the 70 cohort. And then finally, the shift of school leaving age, typically 16 for all these groups, to the requirement to continue in education up until the age of 18 as a graduation age. And that has not necessarily in school any particular route, but to be involved and in touch with education right up until this period. And then finally, in adulthood, Skills for Life, which was a whole huge program devoted to raising adult skills, numeracy and literacy in the population. Okay, well, I better move on. But I just want, the point I want to make is I think mapping the policy outcome against the research evidence is a very important facet of this and shows how that dialogue between policy and evidence is a critical part of the use of these longitudinal studies. And of course, another diagram I was at one time going to show you links, uses the evidence on the left-hand side of this table to pinpoint the other factors involved in the developmental process, which where they're signifying disadvantage can be targets themselves for intervention. You know, for example, free school meals and all the rest of it, but particularly the school curriculum and accommodating those who are missing out on it. So the trajectory of disadvantage begins early, but the poor skills components often unrecognized by teachers. Lack of entry-level skills is associated with poor family conditions. Lack of parental support and low aspirations. Early leaving is typically followed by a disadvantaged employment career, including unemployment spells, poor jobs, lack of ICT experience, and so on. So finally, and this is where the I will end. We haven't time, I think, to go into more detail, but I just wanted to leave you the thoughts about the final challenges in all this. I've presented a very rosy picture how longitudinal evidence and longitudinal study is the solution to so much and where the future lies. On the other hand, a whole myriad of problems grow up around implementation of it. And I'd only want to mention particularly two or three of these. Attrition, the loss of sample, and therefore creating bias in longitudinal data sets, and continuing challenge. The business of respondent burden as measurement becomes more and more complex and complete, a point where, as I think those at the conference in the last few days picked up the point, that there is a bit of a backlash developing as to how much you can expect individuals to do all this. And attrition is the big challenge. There's also, of course, the use of administrative data, that whole world of what that means in terms of opportunities, but also potential problems. And the whole business of generating results that are meaningful and valuable to policy and people on the action side of all of this, and where we go there. And distribution is the point I was making earlier about the need to spread expertise across the world. So I think we can leave it at that, and I'll just hand over. Thank you very much.